Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. No medical exam or health questions will be asked. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. The top topics, the headiest headlines, the debatiest debate. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Ennis, Jordan Heath Rawlings, and Dan Robson. Coming up in the next couple of hours, we will dip our toes into the Olympic waters. Andre DeGrasse's Olympics now complete. Same with Usain Bolt. We'll look ahead to 4 years from now, and will we see another matchup between those two? Or is this it? For real? For Usain Bolt. Christine Sinclair, what a finish to her Olympic Games, back-to-back bronze medals for the Canadian women's soccer team. Who could be the flag bearer as we head to the closing ceremonies in Rio, and the Toronto Maple Leafs miss out on yet another free agent. But, gents, we got to start with the Toronto Blue Jays, who now hold a half-game lead over the Boston Red Sox in the American League East after they dropped the first game of their three-game set in Cleveland to the Indians. They were without Josh Donaldson, without Troy Tulowitzki, and we know that Jose Bautista and Kevin Pillar are on the disabled list. Those are four key guys, but even without them, they were able to carry a lead into the ninth inning, and they had one of the best closers in baseball on the hill. Couldn't get it done as the Indians walk off with a 3-2 win. First ever walk-off inside the park home run loss for the Blue Jays in franchise history. It was ugly. It's just one game, but it's disheartening anytime you lose in the ninth inning with Roberto Osuna on the mound.
Well, Gibby was a little broken up about it after the game.
As I imagine everybody was.
As you would expect, right? But that's a team last night that was missing three of its four best hitters and three of its four best defenders. When you look at Pilar's gone from center and your whole left side of the infield, which has been one of the best in baseball defensively this year, and you can only score two runs supporting them. I'm honestly surprised that it came down to an inside the park home run in the bottom of the ninth inning.
Right, and you have to be happy with Lariano's performance on the mound. I mean, there's takeaways from this. Sometimes one time you lose a game on a walk-off inside the park home run, which was an incredibly exciting play for Cleveland. But Lariano was great. I mean, he had seven strikeouts through five and a half innings. And I mean, I think when you look at how this six-man rotation is working and bringing him in, I do think that you have to be somewhat buoyed by that.
When he's hitting his spots and that slider is working, he can make guys still look silly. I mean, there were a couple of guys that he embarrassed with third strikes in that game. The one where the bat went flying into the dugout, if you watch it, was an embarrassing moment. Like, he's got real stuff when it's working.
Well, and you have to wonder what the impact of having Martin catching him once again is. I know people talked about it, and perhaps people thought, well, what impact can that really have? But I mean, he states it has a big impact, and clearly the value of having Martin back there is showing.
Well, when you're a guy who has trouble locating, having Russell Martin steal you a few strikes here and there is huge, right? It makes a big difference between having guys on base and not having them on.
Yeah, and he's a guy also, despite the fact that the ERA was inflated and the walk numbers were massive in Pittsburgh this year for Francisco Liriano. Last year, he struck out over 200 batters in the National League. He's not that far removed from being a dominant pitcher in baseball. And now he's a guy who's, I guess, nominally the sixth man in a six-man rotation. Who knows how long that lasts? Aaron Sanchez is going to get the start in Game 2 on Saturday. In Cleveland against the Indians, but Shai Davidi reporting before that game one in Cleveland that maybe Aaron Sanchez's next turn through the rotation is skipped, because we knew this was going to take place, right? Because if it's just a six-man rotation, that's the only remedy you have for Aaron Sanchez's ballooning innings numbers. That's not going to be good enough, because it's still going to be way too close to 200 innings by the end of the season. So it's going to take skipping a start or two, which makes it a little more palatable if Francisco Liriano's doing what he did on Friday.
Right, and the starts he'd be skipping would be, I mean, they're playing the Angels and the Twins coming up.
Right.
It's the Orioles that they'd have him come back for, which is going to be one of, the, I mean, once again, the biggest series of the year. So I think that that's not necessarily a bad thing, giving him that little extra rest during this time. They probably plan that the whole time.
Yeah, I think that what you want to make sure you're doing with Sanchez is using him as the difference maker that he should be, right? If you can't beat the Minnesota Twins and the Angels without Aaron Sanchez pitching like a Cy Young winner, then the team has bigger problems than that. And they really need to make sure that he's ready to pitch. I don't know. It doesn't matter to me personally whether it's out of the bullpen or as a starter, but he needs to be ready to pitch in the playoffs.
Let's go back to that game one of that three-game set in Cleveland against the Indians and the final play of the game. It's one play, but when I raise the specter of Michael Saunders' defense, I'm not talking about one play because he's been a guy that's been replaced defensively in the outfield late in games all season long. There's the perception, correctly so, fans and the team itself, that Michael Saunders is a below-average defender in the outfield. And even in Friday's game in Cleveland, it wasn't that final play of the game where really looked like an ill-timed jump. I mean, he jumped up and the ball hit in the middle of the wall. There was plenty of time to get back. Of course, it's easy to second guess when you see the replay 50 times as opposed to being there in the heat of the moment. But there was a ball that dropped in front of him, and we know he's not quite the defender he was before the knee injuries. But yeah, that seems like a deal there, Dan, that Michael Saunders in the outfield defensively is a bit of a concern for the Blue Jays.
Yeah, and it's been a surprising, well, not surprising turnaround for him, but when they brought him here, they were looking for a defender. That's what he was known for, and his bat wasn't that great, and he's turned that around. But as you mentioned, yeah, you have to wonder what the knee injury has done to his ability to defend in the field. It's unfortunate. You know, you want to see him making those plays. I mean, I don't think you can entirely pin the game on him last night.
No.
I mean, it's a play. It happened.
And you only score two runs, and
yeah,
you don't score outside of the first inning.
Yeah, it's. I mean, to be talking, it's a cliche, but it's a team loss in that sense. But it is a question, and I think that's one of the things moving forward when they consider what they're going to do with him as well. I mean, they have to factor that in. Like, how is he someone you can use constantly in the field?
Yeah, I mean, I'd just like to remind us all to keep things into perspective and think
Absolutely
about left
not.
Field. Think about left field last season.
Yeah.
Do you remember Chris Colabello playing left field? And now Michael Saunders, for whatever he's given you, would be a Gold Glove caliber defender compared to Colabello in left field. And Saunders has not been that egregiously bad. He's just been below average, mm-hmm. which, you know, if you're hitting like the All-Star he was, if you're hitting the way he was before the All-Star break, fine, you'll take that, you know, every single night. But we only notice it now because he struggled at the plate since the All-Star break. And now, you know, you're kind of picking holes in his game. Now you're looking at the strikeout rate and you're looking at the errors. And it's really easy to do that when a player is going through a tough time. And I guarantee you he's doing it to himself, you know.
What's the best lineup configuration for this Blue Jays team? Because Justin's, I mean, it's easy. I'm picking low-hanging fruit here with the Saunders defense.
Saunders defense, and now you're going to go to Smoke's batting stance. Okay.
But I think it deserves a conversation because Justin Smoke now 0 for his last 29 with runners in scoring position, which seems almost impossible, but that's the scenario. He's zoning in on the franchise record for 0 for with runners in scoring position in a single calendar season. He's forced into the lineup, of course. We mentioned the number of injuries. But when everybody's healthy, you can have Michael Saunders as your DH with Edwin Encarnacion at first base and Justin Smoke relegated to the bench when Kevin Pillar and Jose Bautista are back in the outfield. Is that something that makes sense? Would you rather see Saunders still in the lineup? Because he was on base twice on Friday in that first game and scored ahead of the Russell Martin home run in the first inning. He's still taking his fair share of walks, despite the fact that the numbers across the board offensively have, yes, been down since the All-Star game. Would you rather just not see Justin Smoke in a starting lineup for the Blue Jays if there are other options?
I think you're counting an awful lot of chickens when you say, you know, when Jose Bautista is back and healthy and Edwin's going to play first base and Kevin Pillar is going to be back in center field. And, you know, yeah, if nobody gets hurt and everybody is healthy and everybody's playing at their top level, yes, I'd prefer to see Smoke on the bench and Saunders at DH and the defense be better because Smoke's been terrible at the plate. But I the reason you have a guy like Justin Smoke who, yeah, is not great with the bat and is suffering through a historically bad stretch at the moment. But the reason you have a guy like that is for that kind of eventuality. That sort of somebody's hurt, we got to shuffle the lineup around, he can play first, he can do this. You know, that's why you have him. So I don't know where you're going to go without it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is what it is. I mean, you can't say look at Smoke and say, well, you know, we need him to be better, or we'll just throw him on the bench. I mean, you've got... we've got Bautista injured. We've got like a lineup that's killer out. So obviously, at this moment, it's more ideal to have a different situation. I don't know if moving Saunders to DH is something that that they discussed. It's actually the first time I've even thought about that. So I don't know if that would work. Is Bautista's defense something that you're concerned about?
Well, there you go. Yeah, and there's another guy who's not what he once was defensively. When he was an average to slightly above average defender, what made him that was his arm, which certainly is not a factor anymore.
Yeah, and he's been getting injured all season. So I mean, when he comes back, do you want to see him in a DH role as much as possible?
And it's you're talking about a couple of guys who are pending free agents as well. You wonder what the decrease in value defensively does to their offseason markets. It's Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. Ben Annis, Jordan Heath Rawlings, Dan Robson. How about this statistic? And it's a frightening one. The Toronto Blue Jays, and yes, they've been good for just over a calendar year now, right? This is, so take that into account when I spout off this incredible statistic. They are now 43-69 in one run games since 2014. That sounds bad, right? That's because it is bad. It's the worst record in one run games in all of the major leagues of baseball in the last 2 years. Does it mean anything? Is there a reason behind it? Can you finger point because of it? Or is that just one of those fluky, weird anomalies that just doesn't seem to make sense?
I don't know the reason behind it, but I do think when you look at a team that wins by hitting home runs and scoring a lot of runs, and when those bats go quiet and when it's not working, it's clear to see that they can't get those sort of runs that, say, you know, Candace was able to get last year, when they're just able to, you know, I don't want to say like play small ball, but get around, get like steal bases, get on, get across the plate. I think that they depend on their sluggers slugging, and that might be part of the equation.
Yeah, it might be part of it, but I mean, there's been a lot of studies in a few sports now that basically show that teams' records in one-run games or one-score games in football bear almost no consistency from year to year, and that they're bound to regress in either direction.
Exactly. So you'd figure the Blue Jays would have regressed over the last three years.
Taking it from 2014 is an arbitrary point to take it from. And whoever made that statistic did it because probably the year before that they were really good in one run games. And, you know, that's when you're picking samples like that and you're trying to look for patterns for something that has no discernible pattern, what you're going to end up doing is figuring out an arbitrary point from which to start that gives you something to talk about. So that's why we have this. And it's frustrating. If you're a fan, it's certainly frustrating to think that, you know, in tight games, they're going to end up holding the short stick. But it's going to change. And, you know, I promise they might be a worse team next year and be way better in one-run games because it doesn't correlate to your winning percentage.
It can help you go from a middling team or a good team to a great team, like
sure, but
that
so
Orioles
can getting,
team a couple of years ago that was incredible in one-run games.
But so can blowing out your opponent, or so can getting blown out, right? It's a cliche to say, but it doesn't matter how many you win by. It really doesn't. So,
well, and also I think, so a lot of those, you're right, a lot of it is it's just luck of the draw, and you expect to be 500-ish in one-run games because it's a flip of the coin game. By definition, it's very close. Anybody can win a one-run game. I will say, though, that generally, and I'm not entirely sure that there's numbers to back this up, but it seems like teams with bad bullpens fare poorly in one-run games. And the Blue Jays earlier this season had trouble getting the ball to Roberto Osuna in the seventh and the eighth inning. Now, they have fix that, especially with Jason Grilley. And Joaquin Benoit has been pretty good, mm-hmm. but Grilley's been one of the best relievers in baseball since he arrived in Toronto. So they haven't played a ton of one-run games. They played a lot of two- and three-run games recently, but I would expect that to, while earlier in the season, yeah, the Blue Jays had trouble in one-run games because they couldn't hold a lead in the seventh and the eighth inning. You feel a little more confident if you're a Blue Jays fan and you're up 3-2 and you have six outs to go and you've got Jason Grilley and Roberto Osuna.
Right. Last night, notwithstanding, I think you take a look at this bullpen right now and say, all right, we're feeling really good about it. We're feeling really good about the fact that we're able to revive a guy like Grilley who came in and had the energy to, being on a winning team. You just see that he's got the intensity that's really taking it to the next level, and that's been a fantastic addition to the back end.
Yeah, he's been unbelievable. A guy with an ERA over 5 with one of the worst teams in Major Leagues of Baseball, the Atlanta Braves, to come over to the Blue Jays and put together some pretty impressive numbers. It's Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Ennis, Jordan Heath Rawlings, and Dan Robson. As I mentioned, the Blue Jays now just a half game up in the division, still lead it, but only a half game up on the Boston Red Sox, and the Orioles a game and a half back of the Blue Jays. And yes, I know it seems like the Blue Jays are the only ones who suffer heartbreaking losses. Well, the Red Sox and Orioles have suffered some pretty heartbreaking losses recently. Orioles, yesterday, they scored 5 runs in the first inning, hit 4 home runs before even recording it out, and lost to the Houston Astros. The Red Sox blew a late lead in Detroit to the Tigers. That was only a couple of days ago. But I will say, I thought all season long that it was going to be a two-team race, the Red Sox and the Blue Jays. And the Orioles are just a game and a half out, but you look at the starting pitching statistics for that team, and you look at that rotation, and you look at the addition they made in Wade Miley, and that's not exactly an inspiring one, and he was beat around Friday night by the Houston Astros. It does seem to me like it's going to come down to the Red Sox and the Blue Jays. Tell me if you disagree.
Yeah, no, I think that, you know, the Orioles have played incredibly well this season, but I think, as everyone said, that, you know, they're not going to be a team that lasts right to the end. So I think you'll see them start to drop off, as you saw last night. I mean, that they had 4 home runs before they had an out yesterday. It was the first time since 1900 that had happened. Yeah. It was incredible. But then they ended up getting blown out. And so I think that you just look at that team and wonder if that success is on its last legs. But then you look over at Boston and you get a little bit worried.
Yeah, I mean, Boston has managed to do what they've done with a mediocre, at best, season from the guy they thought was going to be their ace.
Yeah.
So, and Craig Kimball has been hurt a lot of the year. You know, they've battled what they thought was going to be a lights out bullpen. They've battled injuries in it. And you look at them coming together now, and that is a team with that offense. Mm-hmm. If they get any sort of consistency from their rotation, they can rip off wins.
And I'm, you know, you think about a guy like David Price, and you wonder how long he's going to not play as well as he can. And he's always there as a threat, and I wouldn't bet against him.
Unless it's the playoffs, right?
Oh, come on.
Okay. Even those struggles have been overstated. So you look at this rotation, and yes, it's a 6-man rotation right now, and everybody's starting seemingly once a week because of the off days they've got coming up, and maybe that'll change coming up because they got a couple of off days mm-hmm. coming up. And Shai Davidi, as mentioned, talked about the Blue Jays maybe skipping Aaron Sanchez finally for his next start. J-Hap has his 17 wins. He's 17-3 with an ERA just over 3. Aaron Sanchez up there among the leaders in ERA. We know Marco Estrada, what he's been able to do. It's almost award season. And I know wins aren't what they once were, but are they like a tie-breaking factor? On this Blue Jays team, is it far and away Aaron Sanchez the leader right now, if you had to nominate one Blue Jays starter for the American League Cy Young Award?
If you had to do it right now, today, probably, just because he's been so far and away one of the best pitchers in all of baseball most of the year. But if you look at him getting skipped in the rotation coming up, and they should and probably will do everything possible to keep his innings down and keep him ready for the playoffs. So If you had to bet which Blue Jay will finish highest in Cy Young balloting, first of all, I'd like to say it's amazing that we are even having this conversation in late August when you looked at this rotation at the beginning.
I thought they were just going to have to outslug everybody.
Well, no, but even if you looked at the rotation at the beginning of the season and said, of these guys who are going to be in the starting rotation, who has the best chance of winning the Cy Young? I think almost everybody would have said Marcus Stroman, right? That was the hype. That was the buzz. Oh, yeah. Features about him being the ace. He looked great. And now here you are, and he is fourth in line in terms of Cy Young qualifications among Jays starters.
What a good problem to have, though.
It's incredible. Like, Estrada and Happ are combined making less than David Price is this year.
Yeah, and I mean, the Jay Happ signing, I know everyone sort of scratched their heads and thought, what's happening? But I mean, that has clearly paid off, and the Jays did their homework on that and knew that he something worked for him in Pittsburgh, and he is, I mean, it's incredible that he's in that conversation.
It's amazing also that this rotation returns almost entirely intact for next season. It's a six-man rotation right now, so you lose R.A. Dickey in 2017. You got a five-man rotation. All those five starters are returning in 2017. They have young, controllable arms. And yes, Marcus Stroman has had his bumps in the road this season, but it's been
great lately.
Yeah, it's been it's almost been like a sandwich-type season where he started off well, had a crummy middle there, and then, you know, the other slice of bread is being slapped on here, and he's been good again.
Yeah, he didn't even start off fantastically, but he had a good beginning to the season, and then he just got hit a lot. And I mean, my own personal pet theory that I've extolled around here is that in his quest to become that 200-inning starter, that ace that can anchor the rotation and go deep in every game, he pitched a lot more to contact. I mean, he was saying that himself, and it turned him into a great ground ball pitcher, but it also meant that he got hit harder, and his BABIP went up, and he was trying to go deeper in games. And now I think you've seen the last month and a half, his Ks per nine are way up because he's trying to get out of trouble by missing bats again, even if that costs him an extra 10, 15 pitches. It means he only pitches into the sixth instead of into the eighth, but you get out of there with having only allowed four or five hits instead of 10.
So we mentioned Jose Bautista and Michael Saunders, both free agents at the end of the season. We all know that. That's a fact. One guy, despite the fact that he's having a bad second half of the season, Michael Saunders has certainly increased his value from a perception standpoint to where he was preseason. Nobody knew if he'd be able to stay healthy, and certainly nobody knew if he'd be able to put up these kind of numbers offensively. Mm-hmm. Even if he ends up where he is right now, that's a very, very good season for Michael Saunders. Jose Bautista has battled injuries, and even when he was healthy, the numbers were not exactly Jose Bautista-ish. It's fine. Very good, and an above-average offensive player, despite hitting .220 with the on-base well over .300 and still hit for power. And the injuries he's suffered this season have been fluke in nature. It's not hamstring strains. It's banging your toe into the outfield wall in Philadelphia. But if he doesn't end up with the counting statistics, certainly like that $100 million contract that he was hoping to get that maybe he wrote down on a napkin.
That number that he gave them, I've given them my number, and that's it.
Yeah, well, that seems like
it's not it.
It seems like it might not be it. But could that be good for the Blue Jays in that maybe there's a chance they can retain him?
Yeah, I think definitely his leverage has gone down somewhat. But if he were to return and have an exceptional September and a run through October and put some exciting numbers up there, I think he's going to be right back to where he was and asking for the same amount of money.
Yeah, I mean, Jose has we all know that he knows what he's worth, and he believes in himself, and he believes in what he should be getting. And if he comes back, a week or two from now and blows it up and flips one more bat in the playoffs or whatever, right, he's going to be right back up there asking for $20 million a season. And, you know, if he shows that he could be healthy the rest of the way and produce, then somebody's going to give it to him because he is still that difference maker.
And if he doesn't, it does create that question. I mean, what do the Jays do in the offseason? And I think for a while it was just sort of assumed he'd be gone based on that. But I think now I wonder if Bautista sticks around a little bit longer and the Jays are able to get him. I know he hates the idea of a hometown discount because apparently he gave us one before, the Toronto one before. But I think that definitely creates some more interesting questions for what this team will look like next year.
See, I think that the ownership of this team and the front office would be crazy to keep Jose Bautista over Edwin Encarnacion if there's anything even close to similar salaries. You know, if we're talking about like, you give Jose Bautista a qualifying offer and he somehow takes it because he doesn't think he can get a lot else out there. Or, you know, Edwin is asking for $35 million a season for five seasons and you're just like, well, we probably can't. But if we're talking about, you know, the difference between a $15 million player and a $25 million player or whatever, I just think Edwin means so much more to the Blue Jays. And he's younger and he fits better, to me at least.
Yeah, and he's had an incredible year this year. But yeah. I think he's also going to be a larger target because of that from other teams.
Oh, absolutely.
And I don't know how you go up against the Boston Red Sox and trying to replace David Ortiz.
With big sacks of money. That's the only way you ever go up against the Red Sox and the Yankees.
Hey, that'd be incredible if they were to do it. I think it'll be an interesting thing, and we'll see. He's going to be able to demand top dollar. So will they look around and say, how long is he going to want? You know, he's 30. He's going to be, 34?
Yeah, he'll 34. Be 34, 35. But the thing about it is, you look at this team and everything that they've done for the company that owns them, and you know the money's been pouring in there, way up there in terms of attendance.
It's leading the American League.
Leading the American League. It's been at fourth and overall in all of baseball. I think like it's been an insane turnaround. You know, and that's worth something. That's worth real money.
Yep.
And if you can keep that going by paying Edwin a sack full of money, you know that's a call you might have to make.
Oh, and speaking of sacks full of money. Joey Votto makes him, and I want to talk about him because I can't get his name out of my head. Like it's like a disease with me. So we'll spend, I don't know, 10 minutes or so on Joey Votto and the fit that he makes in Toronto.
The most discussed non-Blue Jay in all of baseball.
Right. For now. Joey Votto talk coming up next. It's Sportsnet Magazine Live. Ben Ennis alongside Jordan Heath Rawlings and Dan Robson. This is the Sportsnet Radio Network.
This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Ennis, Jordan Heath Rawlings, and Dan Robson. The playoff rosters have to be set by September. And this is, you get a lot of questions on Twitter about this. People are confused about how it works that, oh, well, you got to be on the 40-man roster by September. No, you just have to be in the organization by September if you want to be eligible for the postseason. So there's still time, and there's still the potential for massive moves to be made despite the fact that we're past the non-waiver trade deadline. Lots of big deals get made in August. What it means is that, and just about everybody in baseball has put on these things called optional waivers, recallable waivers, where you put the player on it. If he's claimed, you can say, nah, we were just kidding, ha ha ha, and cancel that waiver claim, retain the player, or you can just let him go for nothing, or you can try and work out a trade with that team. And if nobody claims him, then he's free to be traded anywhere.
Unless he has a no-trade clause.
Unless he has a no-trade clause, which brings us to Joey Votto. And I don't know if people are getting sick of me talking about it. I doubt it because I'm sure just about everybody wants to bring Joey Votto back to Toronto.
Everybody wants to fantasize.
Of course. Is it fantasy, though? Because the Cincinnati Reds are very clearly in a rebuild mode. He's due almost $200 million still remaining on the contract. Almost $200 million. But he's worth it.
If there was ever a time for it to make sense, this is that time, given the reality of what's happening in Cincinnati and what's happening in Toronto. It just seems like everything's sort of aligned. For a time, like when he signed the 12-year deal, it was like, well, Joey Votto's never going to play in Toronto. Mm-hmm. It's just not going to happen. He's committed there. But the reality is that he has, I mean, it's one of the best hitters in the game, one of the best hitters all time. He's fantastic. So, I mean, if there's an opportunity to do it, the question is it worth it when it comes to dollars and cents?
Well, I mean, everything's perfectly aligned except for the almost $200 million
right.
that he's still owed, which, yes, could be taken on by any team that wanted to do it, but you know would make even the Red Sox and the Yankees think twice. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of money. I'm not saying that it can't be done, but you know, we're talking right now, or we just finished talking right now, about whether they should pay Edwin Encarnacion or Jose Bautista, because the premise is already that they can't keep both. So as much as I'd like to see it as well, I think there's some serious roadblocks in the way.
Right, but if they're going to spend that kind of money on any player, spending it on a hometown guy, the best baseball player we've
should
ever produced.
Should that be a factor?
I do think it should be a factor, because it's going to sell a ton of jerseys and people are going to pay attention.
Three Canadians in the starting lineup would be quite a thing.
It really worked well for Brett Laurie, too. Yeah.
I think the popularity of some, like, I do think that there's something to the hometown reality. There's a kid who grew up playing in Etobicoke, coming and playing for the Jays in a time when they have a legitimate shot at going far in the playoffs, you know, with him, dare I say, further than, you know, the ALCS. I mean, it would be an incredible opportunity, and I think it's one of those he's one of those players that would just the energy is already around the Jays.
How much higher can you pump up the energy around the Jays? I mean, we're already looking at sellouts basically in every game, and the TV ratings are record high, and so I'm not saying I'm totally in agreement with you that, like, it would be a really cool thing to do and it would be awesome to watch the hometown kid make good, but what I'm saying is, if you look at it from a dollars and cents point of view, and you look at it like, well, it's not like they're going to sell X thousand more tickets. They're already selling all the tickets.
No, but they are raising ticket prices by 7% next season.
That's true, and you want to make sure you're still winning, or the fans are going to get upset about that ticket price hike very quickly.
I don't think that you go, well, we're popular enough, people like us enough, we're good. Like, I think that they're going to say, this is a player that, like, aside from the hometown thing, I think the hometown thing's an incredible storyline that goes along with it. And obviously, I love storylines, so I think it's great. Mm-hmm. But as a baseball player, he is in a list of some of the greatest hitters of all time. They can't play the shift on him. He hits to both sides of the field with power.
Takes an incredible number of walks.
Yeah, great on base percentages.
He's a brilliant batter.
None of us are gonna debate that. And what I'm saying is not so much like, oh, we're popular enough, but if you look at it from a business point of view, there's a law of diminishing returns that comes into play. When you're trying to pack the house, you're trying to create record ratings and all that kind of stuff. That stuff is already happening. I'm not saying that means they can't do it, because there's definitely, you'd sell more jerseys, you know, there would be even more media attention and that kind of stuff. But at the same time, just in terms of the bottom line, how much is that bottom line impacted by bringing another super expensive long-term player?
Well, it changes your thinking in 2017, because, yes, well, in 2016, maybe they're at max capacity as far as interest and attention and ratings and attendance and all that. But in 2017, yes, you do have three major pending free agents in Michael Saunders, Jose Bautista, Edwin Encarnacion. Even if you lose all three, having Joey Votto, Josh Donaldson, Troy Tulowitzki, Russell Martin, Devin Travis as your core of your offense, that's not half bad.
No, it's not at all. But let me ask you, would you rather them trade for Joey Votto and keep Votto, and if that means losing out on Bautista and Edwin and Saunders? So none of those three are coming back, but you're cool with that because you got Joey Votto.
Yeah.
I would be. Yeah.
You wouldn't rather keep Edwin?
I think
Joey Votto's better than Edwin Encarnacion.
You're paying a ton of money for those guys anyway next year. You're paying a lot of money.
Yes.
So I think we have to look at that factor too. Like, these guys aren't on contract for what they're making next year. You're not getting all of them back. If you have a chance to get a guy like Votto at a price that they're likely per season going to be looking at, I would say you definitely look at that as an option. And whether maybe Cincinnati takes something, I don't know. I mean, they're trying to rebuild. It's an albatross for both Votto and for Cincinnati. I mean, as much as making tons of money can be a problem, but, like, it's, I think that, yeah, you definitely look at that and say, yeah, maybe Votto's worth it.
I mean, that's interesting, because I do think that having Votto at first base with Donaldson at third and Tulowitzki at short, and it sounds like Devin Travis at second, who's proving himself to be a darn good every day.
And your catcher is Russell Martin.
Yeah. Best in the league, for sure. But when I ask myself, would I rather have Joey Votto playing first base for this team and hitting next year, or would I rather have Encarnacion, I think I side with Edwin because... Why? Oh my goodness! They're
because
not that
he's
different.
Younger. Yeah, they are. They're quite a bit different now. Edwin's maybe got a little more
power.
Home run
he's got
power.
He's got more pop, and Votto's a much more patient hitter at the plate.
Joey Votto's slugging .515, right? Like, the OPS. He had an OPS of 1,000 last year. This year it's .945 after a pretty mediocre start to the season. Second half of the year, he's ridiculous. And he's an elite defender at first base.
Like I said, I'm not here to question whether or not Joey Votto is a great baseball player. The other thing that we should probably talk about in this is that he has to want to come here.
Yeah. Well, that's a full no trade.
Yeah, and I mean, just at that point, I mean, in weighted runs created plus, he was 15th overall all time before the season began. The only person that's better actively right now is Mike Trout. That's the only person. He's just behind like Stan Musial.
There's no question that he's one of the best hitters in the history of the game.
So I think that's why you go, okay, well, we're spending lots of money, so let's look at how we want to spend this. But yes, that's the question: is does he want to come to the city where he would have more attention paid to him than ever?
Dozens of microphones in his face every day,
and an insanely he's known to be, you know, very, very private. He's in a small market. It's a nice place. It's a nice place to be where he's not getting all that crazy attention.
Oh, lovely Cincinnati.
But the thing is, he's not the dude here, right? Like, it's still Josh Donaldson's team if he arrives.
But he's the Canadian.
Right. And certainly when he first arrives, he'll get plenty of attention.
All the time. Nobody's going to forget about him and be like, oh, look, Josh Donaldson's over here. Joey Votto is the best Canadian baseball player ever.
Yeah, there's going to be more attention on Josh Donaldson.
Yeah. I mean, I think that when it comes down to what this team winning and playing, I mean, Josh Donaldson is the leader of this team. I mean, I think that he'll get that attention. Obviously, reporters are going to ask Votto a ton of questions if he would come here, and fans would want a ton of autographs, and that would be part of it. But he'd also be on a team that can win, which is something he hasn't done before.
It's okay. Yeah. It seems pie in the sky, and maybe it is. But and the numbers, when you're talking about dollars and cents, are massive. Mm-hmm. And it seems like there's not a team in Major League Baseball that would be able to just absorb the entire deal. He'll probably get through recallable waivers, optional waivers here in August. And apparently, you can get the Reds to pick up part of the tab. And, of course, the amount of the remaining dollars on that deal that they pick up is dependent on the return that you give them in young player capital. But as far as the money itself is concerned, because in years past, we talked about the Blue Jays being very stringent to their budget and needing to adhere to a very specific number and having very little wiggle room, especially at this point in the season, that Alex Anthopoulos, you know, he had a war chest that he could use late in the season to acquire assets, but couldn't go over a certain number. We've seen this Blue Jays team be a little more free with the dollars. They're paying $13 million plus to Francisco Liriano, who had an ERA over 5 in the National League. And they took all of that contract and they got a couple of prospects in return because they were able to flex their financial muscle. And while they're only paying 5 of the $22 million remaining on Melvin Upton Jr.'s contract, the Baltimore Orioles weren't willing to do it. And that's why the Blue Jays were able to get Upton and the Orioles weren't. Maybe we are seeing a changing of the guard. I mentioned the ticket price increase
in
2017. This would be definitely a sea change to be one of those big money clubs to go and acquire a guy like Joey Votto with that big, big ticket.
What is he like? It's about like $33 million a year or something like that. For if you factor what he would cost.
What he's worth? Like, well, if Joey Votto, if you're paying him for what he's worth, he's a $40 million player.
Right.
But he's making $20 million this year, $22 million in 2017, and then $25 million per through the 2023 season, and then he's got a team option for $20 million in 2024 and a $7 million buyout.
Yeah, so
it's
cars. Exactly. But you know, I do think, as we sort of talked about a little earlier when we were talking about paying Edwin or Batista, I think you are seeing this team realize the financial benefits of just spending to create a perpetual winner. I think they definitely do not want to go back next year to scrabbling to be relevant, because they realize that, yes, it might cost an extra $50 million to beef up this team's payroll, but the return is going to be more than that. Like, this city's proven, this country has proven that it's willing to pony up and tune in and come to games.
And I mean, this happened 3 years ago. They went from $92 million payroll in 2012 to $126 million in 2013.
Yeah.
Since then, they're up $10 million more this year through trade. But they've said and they've seen the impact in it. I mean, like you said earlier, record ratings, the best attendance in the American League. Fans, half the stadium last night in Cleveland was Toronto fans.
Yeah.
Like, it's that all pays dividends, and I think that people are paying attention to that reality.
Yeah, and the ownership of the team has to notice that owning this team brings about a lot of positive attention right now.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and that's, but that you can't put it price on that. I mean, you guess you can because your stock goes up. But, you know, like that's something that is worth the investment in terms of keeping fans from sliding back into that cynicism that has surrounded so much of Toronto sports for the last decade, right?
And it's almost stupid to talk about it making sense in a baseball sense because it makes almost too much sense. And while the Red Sox, yeah, they could find a way to make it work, it's tough this season because they have Hanley Ramirez, who doesn't have a position, who's playing first base, and they have David Ortiz still in 2016. Now in 2017, things get different, of course, when David Ortiz retires. But
Blue Pablo
Jays,
Sandoval is going to be healthy for right, 2017.
Right, forgot about that dude. But yeah, for right away, the Blue Jays just throw Joey Votto in there, and he's your replacement for Justin Smoke.
Sounds good to me. Sign me up.
Yeah. Again, it's pie in the sky stuff, but yeah, kind of makes a lot of sense.
Sure. Let's let it happen. It's fine.
When we come back, we're into the final couple of days of the Rio Olympics. What a games it's been for the Canadians, including Andre DeGrasse. Who should be the flag bearer? That's next. Ben Ennis alongside Jordan Heath Rawlings and Dan Robson. It's Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake doctor's orders. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. If it's a sports story you're talking about, you can guarantee they'll be talking about it. Unless it's something like arena football. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590. The Fan. One, two, three.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Ennis, Jordan Heath Rawlings, Dan Robson, Rio Games, down to the short strokes. What games it's been for the Canadians. We'll talk about the overall success of this country at the 2016 games in just a bit, but it's just wrapped up. Andre DeGrasse versus Usain Bolt. They competed in their final events in the 4x100-meter relay Friday night, and it looked like Canada was going to be held off the podium, finishing fourth, but then a disqualification for the Americans meant a bronze for Mr. DeGrasse, his third medal of these games for the 21-year-old. And the story early was the budding relationship between the 21-year-old and the 29-year-old Usain Bolt. They were buddy-buddy, they were smiling at each other, they were pointing at each other. And then that seemed to wane a little bit, certainly when DeGrasse came within 0.02 of a second of Bolt in that 200-meter semifinal. Bolt blew away the pack in the final of that event. But it's been certainly a coming-out party for Andre DeGrasse. Everybody knows Usain Bolt is great, and this is not unexpected what Bolt has been able to do. And we hoped that DeGrasse would be able to put his name on the level of some of the great sprinters in this world, and he's done so.
Yeah, he's become one of the storylines of the Olympics, not just for Canadian commentators. He's become one of the guys to watch, and the future of sprinting, which is, you know, the marquee event. So, I mean, he has an incredible future ahead of him, and I think you know, the next two Olympics are going to be incredibly exciting to watch.
Yeah, although I will say that calling it versus Usain Bolt is a little bit of a misnomer, because aside from that one semifinal where it clearly Bolt was just trying to cruise, and then
sure,
DeGrasse came up on him and he was like, all right, I'll run a little faster now. Mm-hmm. But other than that, it wasn't a contest.
He blew him away.
Nobody's close.
Nobody's close to Usain Bolt. He's on a level all his own. And we can get into the discussion if you want, because now he's completed the triple-triple, as we're calling it in Canada, because naturally, that's too much sugar for me, a triple-triple. But yeah, we're calling it the triple-triple. Three straight Olympics, winning the 100, the 200, and the 4x100 in all three for Usain Bolt. And yes, that's only 9 golds, making him the second most decorated Olympian all time as far as gold medals, behind Michael Phelps' 22. But Michael Phelps has so many more opportunities. Usain Bolt, in my eyes, is the greatest Olympian of all time.
Yeah, I mean, I don't love the debate of greatest Olympian in these senses, because I think you're really it's difficult to compare sports. Yeah. I mean, the nature of you could have someone win a ton of medals in something, but like you said, you don't have the opportunity to. So it depends on, I think you just have to look at the margin of winning and how they're winning. And I think that there's no, Michael Phelps deserves to be in that conversation. Absolutely. But I mean, Usain Bolt is winning and it seems like he's laughing as he's winning, which is, it's madness.
Why would he stop? Because that's the conventional wisdom when he ran that 200 meter was, it's his final individual race. And then Friday night in the 4x100, his final Olympic event, Usain Bolt, and he said as much. But yes, Michael Phelps said the same thing 4 years ago in London. Things change. He's turning 30. Sunday is Usain Bolt. You can still compete into your mid-30s in sprinting. Justin Gatlin's there. Is he doing it on the up and up? That's maybe another question. But certainly you'd think Usain Bolt, with his size, with his freakishness, could win a gold medal or two or three in 4 years' time in Tokyo. Why wouldn't he?
It's possible for sure. He said he's retiring. And, you know, there's something to be said for a guy like that who seems so inhuman and totally, mythological and unbeatable and like a force of nature, you know, to not want to come back in any way, in a manner that would tarnish that or leave us with a memory that isn't, you know, Usain Bolt running as fast as he wants to almost, right? Like, I feel like he definitely could come back and win another medal or two. But if you see him in 4 years in Tokyo and he's running and, you know, he loses to DeGrasse in the 100 meters and, you know, he's not Bolt, capital B anymore. He's just another Olympian.
I think Bolt knows, he understands the media very well. He understands the storyline of like, this is the triple-triple and I'm retiring in this moment. I mean, he gets that. I don't think he's actually made a decision. I think he's going to see how things go, how his body holds up. And if he can still like win races laughing, I mean, I think you will definitely see him because it's benefits.
If he's still like that, you probably will. Yeah.
Even if he regressed a bit, he's still going to be a length ahead of other people.
Also true. Yeah.
Well, in 4 years' time, yes, there's the regression happening for Usain Bolt. And I'm not 100% buying that one either. But Andre DeGrasse, despite the fact that he's 21 years old, and that should be the prime sprinting years, he's new to the sport. And you wonder what 4 years of experience, this being his first Olympic Games, you wonder where he is in 4 years. And yes, we can joke about it's not really his rival in 2016, Usain Bolt and Andre DeGrasse, because he's just so much further back. Everybody is. Maybe in 4 years, that's not the case when Andre DeGrasse is able to take the experiences learned here in 2016 in Rio and apply them to Tokyo in 4 years.
Well, you read Evan Rosser's story in our Olympic preview about Andre DeGrasse and just how much he's learned so recently. Mm-hmm. You know, there's probably no other Olympic level sprinter in the world who is still being taught the finer points of technique, you know, in the months leading up to his Olympic debut. It's really impressive that he's able to, with that raw speed, especially because he's not like Usain Bolt. He's not a gigantic freak of nature, who can leap tall buildings. He's a tiny little guy whose technique is not perfect. So everything that makes him special is raw speed, which is really exciting when you think about the future.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you look forward and say there's room, absolute room for improvement, which is the same thing with Penny Oleksiak in the pool. She's 16 years old and basically just still learning and getting stronger. So that's just the beginning of something that's great there as well.
All right, Dan, let's have the conversation because, it's going to be a spicy debate here coming up to the closing ceremonies in Rio. Who should be the flag bearer? Rosie McLennan carried the flag going in and did a great job of defending her gold medal. But certainly there's been some names. It seems like it's a two-horse race, and maybe we'll talk about Christine Sinclair. Should she be in the running as well? Another bronze medal, the Canadian women's soccer team winning that bronze medal match against the host nation, the Brazilians. You've got Andre DeGrasse with his three sprinting medals, historic for a Canadian man. Penny Oleksiak, she's 16, four swimming medals, including a gold in the marquee event in the pool. She's going to have future opportunities being only 16 years old, but so is Andre DeGrasse. Is Christine Sinclair, should that play into it? Who you got?
I got Penny. I think Penny, absolutely, because she has the gold medal. I think you look at it. I mean, we have a ton of bronze, and that's great, but it seems like bronze is like the Canadian gold. Like, it's the gold medal is the top, and she won it in the marquee event in her in her racing, in her event. And I think that absolutely, I actually don't even see it as a debate. I mean, DeGrasse deserves a ton of credit, but he didn't win gold.
Right, but he's...
Yeah, you don't carry my flag unless you got a gold medal around your neck. That's the way I want it.
Three medals in sprinting by a Canadian man has never happened before.
It's okay. It's great. No, obviously DeGrasse's performance was amazing, but if I'm looking at who's going to actually represent Canada at the closing ceremonies with the flag, I want somebody that has been the number one person in an event. I want someone with gold around their neck.
Yeah, I think you have to reward that the fact that like it's you're the first gold medal we had, and you were the story. I mean, that was so exciting. I know, like as our attention span tends to wane, we watch sports. It's like, what happened? What have you done for me lately? Yeah. Well, like a couple weeks ago, you like ignited the passion that Canadians had across this country for the Olympics. And this has been an exciting Olympics to watch. And that was the beginning of it all.
And this is the one thing that I will say, because I promise you that they're thinking about this. When this Olympics started, for the first week plus of the Olympics, the Canadian women were so dominant and so huge a part of what we were doing as a country. It was amazing. And I mean, their performances are still incredible, but they carried this nation for a week of the Olympics. And I promise you that the Canadian Olympic Committee, when they're choosing that flag bearer, is thinking about the optics of having the women utterly dominate the Olympics for Canada and then giving the flag to a man for the closing ceremonies. They will think about that, and it should be Penny.
I know Christine Sinclair doesn't have the all-important gold medal that you guys are talking about, but if you are talking about a wonderful parting gift, it would be really, really emotional, especially you watch John Erdman after that bronze medal match talking about her losing her father in recent months, to have her waving the flag in what might be her final Olympics. That could be a pretty moving story as well.
You won't see me upset if they were to choose Christine Sinclair. I mean, she's one of our great Olympians, and she's just watching them yesterday. It was so emotional. It's just hard not to feel for her, and to see what I mean, to be 33 years old on this next generation of Canadian soccer and how exciting they've been. I mean, I think there's a sentimental vote there for sure. And I mean, look, I'm a sentimentalist. I would cast a vote there too if you asked me to.
So Canada with 21 medals to this point, and still a couple of opportunities remaining in the final couple of days in Rio, surpassing the total in London. And certainly when it comes to golds, because we only won one 4 years ago, and it was in trampoline. Now with three this quadrennial success, unqualified success for Canada. Do we look at the medal count as being a big measuring stick 4 years by 4 years? It seemed like the excitement has continued. There was a streak there where it seemed like 12 straight. I think it was 12 straight days Canadians won at least a medal. I don't see anybody talking about it being a disappointment. Seems like it's pretty successful for this country.
I mean, I wouldn't judge an Olympics solely on like the raw medal count or whatever, but if you're looking at what Canada's done in this Olympics, they've put new faces on the map. Older athletes, like we just mentioned Sinclair, who are retiring, managed to do a couple of great things before they left. I mean, you even have Eric Lamaze in show jumping coming through with the bronze. Like older Olympians, older Olympians, younger Olympians.
By the way, does the horse get a medal? I don't think he does.
I know, which is medal. Yeah, he should get a horse-sized medal.
It's a bad.
Yeah, it's unfair. But, my main point is just that I think you judge the success of a nation's Olympics based on who it brings out and puts on the podium and the stories that it gives you. And I think by those measures, it's been an incredibly successful Olympics. I mean, two new young stars that should be, dominant in their events going forward.
Yeah, and I think by both measures, it is. I mean, I think we can definitely look at it and say, yes, Canada, they surpassed what they wanted to do. And I mean, if just on that measure alone, you can do it. But in terms of Canadians paying attention, people getting, but I think that people care about our Olympic athletes, and I think that you're seeing a lot of the success and the work that they put in for all that time. So I think it's been really nice to watch.
And compelling stories too. I mean, the way that those medals were won, the way, like I mentioned, the women utterly dominated the first week, the way DeGrasse emerged on the scene. Like these are stories, even Damian Warner's come from behind kind of to grab that bronze medal. That's all of these things play into, the success of an Olympics, because you'll remember that.
Yeah, and one thing I do think too, it's interesting. I don't want to be like super pat Canadians in the back, but when you look at how Canadians come off in these games, like there's a class. Like our athletes have this sort of I mean, it's like, you know, out in Vancouver in those last Olympics, and you just see a guy like that and you're like, you know, he represents what the best ideal that we have for ourselves is. And all of these athletes that you see have done it. And we don't have a Ryan Lochte kind of guy. So we have people that I think that we're just proud of how they've done. So
you're Mr. Segway, right? Bringing up Ryan Lochte. Let's talk about Ryan Lochte, who, by the way, doesn't have silver hair apparently anymore. That was his first order of business upon returning.
I heard
to
him
United
called
States.
The real Swim Shady.
Yeah,
I've heard lots.
I've heard the Lochte Mess Monster. Yeah, I've heard
Lochte Mess Monster.
Yeah, I've seen lots of stuff when it
Watergate.
Yeah, there's a lot. Yeah, it's embarrassing. He lied. he told people that he was robbed, and he told people he had a gun pointed to his head, which seems like that was the truth. It did seem like it certainly, if you're from a place where you commit some act of petty vandalism, you're not likely to have a gun pointed at your head. If you come from a place like that and you end up in that situation, I imagine it's frightening, but boy, is it embarrassing and a black mark, on him. And you can understand to a degree the Brazilian authorities really going full bore at him, because that was a high-profile athlete just wearing those stereotypes that we thought we would see plenty in Rio. And there have been stories of robberies and muggings and stick-ups in
Rio. But that was the big one. The Lochte one was the big one when
because
it happened.
Ryan Lochte was a celebrity.
He's a star.
Yeah. I mean, but I need to give Ryan Lochte the benefit of it's like one of the worst things it hurts, but they did have guns pulled on them by security guards. Like, it is a little,
sure.
It's strange he lied about it, but that experience in itself was a bit strange. Like, where do you like get demanded cash and then like pay, and they've got like guns. Like, I get that he was riled up, and then he's just apparently a liar and told a different story, but that story to begin with was enough.
But he lied about, like, those are serious things that he's lying about. And he's not, this is my big gripe with this story, is that it's being treated like he was a kid who lied, and it's embarrassing. He's a 32-year-old man lying about police officers pointing guns at his head. Like, this isn't play around type stuff, you know? This is an actual criminal offense. I say, throw him in jail.
Yeah, it seems a bit extreme, but it's certainly what he did was illegal in falsifying a police report.
There you go.
I don't understand what the problem would have been in just telling the truth. Yeah. I mean, I guess it's embarrassing that you were caught.
That's embarrassing now.
Right. Well, yeah, obviously the cover-up is always more embarrassing than the actual crime. But if they just came out and told everybody what actually happened, people would have said, okay, you're pretty stupid to do what you did, but we understand you got a little too liquored up, and boy, that's kind of crazy. Yeah, you had guns pointed at your head, but the way they've turned it into this, hey, and the details of the story about these guys dressed up as police officers and they stopped the cab is just
and they
so
pointed a gun to my head, and I said, "Whatever, dude."
Yeah, that's, like, I think that was the first
instance where we maybe should have started to doubt what was going on here. Oh yeah, they pointed a gun to my head. I was like, "Whatever." Yeah. It's embarrassing to Ryan Lochte, of course.
Yeah,
embarrassing to USA Swimming. But the problem, I don't mind those guys being embarrassed. It's embarrassing to a city that everybody doubted could stage an Olympic Games that wasn't going to be a disaster. And, you know, minus some smaller incidents here and there, looks to have done exactly that. And for it almost to get derailed by this concocted story.
Well, I mean, and they put the hammer down pretty hard and pulled people off the plane and made a point of saying this wasn't true. I don't think it's embarrassing for Ryan Lochte. I think Ryan Lochte's done more embarrassing things many, many times.
Oh my God. I want to hear about those stories.
I don't think personally for him.
Tried to trademark Ja.
I don't think he's embarrassed. He wears grills and says Ja. Like,
yeah, he has little shame. That's true.
It's not something for him. I don't think he's even thinking twice about this right now.
No, this seems like a black mark that's going to follow him around, because you're right. It's tough when you're universally known as the dumb guy and everybody just says, oh, yeah, he's a dumb guy. And there's no dissenters on that. And that was previous to this incident. But now this is one of the first things on his Wikipedia page now. It's going to follow him around for the rest of his life.
You can tell. That's why he dyed his hair.
No.
But also, I mean, his swimming career is basically 32 years old, as you said. I mean, he only has so much fame left.
I know, and what a way to go out.
Right.
It's consistent, is all I'm saying. It's consistent.
He is who he is. Nochte's doubting who Ryan Lochte is anymore.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Ennis, Jordan Heath Rawlings, and Dan Robson. So overall, though, I was guilty previous to these Olympics, like I was during the Sochi games. Like
me
I
too,
have
by the way. Me too.
In previous games, I think just about everybody was. Oh, this is different. I know you hear this before every Olympic games, but this is, there's really some serious issues here in Rio. The police aren't being paid. None of the venues are ready. It's going to be an abject disaster. The living quarters for the athletes is terrible. Meh. Yeah. We had some discolored water was the biggest, I think, takeaway when you look at a screw up.
Actually were some robberies, right?
Sure.
There have been robberies and thefts and all sorts of things from the Olympic Village. And
yeah, but I imagine that happens at every Olympic Games. But nothing massive, nothing that
seems pretty
overwhelmed,
minor so far. Yeah, yeah.
The entire game.
The biggest problems with the games in Rio is what will last after and what came before. It's people getting displaced from their homes for.
But that's every Olympic Games, and we don't care about that, right? We just care about the 2 weeks that.
And
the
I will
games
say that Rio
place.
Built a transportation system for these games that it didn't have before, which should be a positive legacy.
Right, but it went to wealthy communities. I mean, we don't need to get into all of that, but it's not necessarily like they were doing good for the poor people of Rio. These games have not done good for the poor people of Rio. And that's a discussion that you'll see lots of stories about and you saw before. But what happens inevitably is we pay attention to the games, and the games have gone on, green water aside, quite well.
Yeah, it's those social economic discussions, they take place and they are real.
Yeah.
And certainly
in every Olympics.
Yeah, every
Olympics are never good for poor people.
How'd that
in
work
general.
Out for Athens or Vancouver seems fine, but yeah, across the world there's dilapidated stadia that have been used for Olympic games that go unused for decades to come after those games. That's just part of
all those things are not
Olympics.
Housing projects.
When the games take place in places where there's real economic disparity, though. I mean, like Vancouver, there's issues in Vancouver for sure, and everywhere in the world. But there are these issues that will come, from Rio. But I think there are issues that we talked about before, and that and afterwards they can look back on and say, well, what was the legacy of these games for Brazil in general.
Yeah, and I don't think you really end up knowing until years afterwards, right? It's easy to look at it now and say, there's a transportation system, but it's not for poor people and we don't know. We just don't know. But I think that the average audience, that's the thing to remember. The people watching these games, by and large, have shown that they don't really care once the games start, right? Nobody has been scrambling to hear more of these stories. The only time people did pay attention is when it was something so bizarre that it later turned out to be fake.
There was a couple of stories about like some of the venues not the fans not really being in the stands, and then them saying, well, we sold the tickets, but they just got so enamored with the village. People were just walking around. They don't want to actually watch the events. I don't know the truth there, but it's not an uncommon situation when it comes to the
it's
games.
It's not like this would be the first games
this
with
many events.
Empty seats. Yeah,
right.
Especially for, the quarterfinals of the javelin throwing competition. There are marquee events at the Olympics that will always be packed, and there are hundreds and hundreds of events that probably will never sell out. That's not the point of the Olympics, I don't think.
Yeah, but I think in an overall sense, we will look back at these games as being pretty successful. And that some of the major problems we thought could be an issue, especially when you're talking about policing and you're talking about protests at the airport in which the police officers are saying, hey, we're not getting paid here. Good luck with your Olympic Games. We can't protect you because we're actually not being paid. Now, I'm sure there are serious issues that are taking place here, but for at least these 2 weeks here, it seems like everybody's been able to do what they do and compete in an Olympic Games without any outside problems.
It'll be interesting to see too, a couple weeks after the games, and I don't expect to hear about it, but certainly if there were going to be after effects from, say, the poop water that everybody was talking about,
or the
Zika virus or stuff like that, like those are the things you might hear about a little bit later on, right?
I guess, but yeah.
Maybe.
How was the water in the end? Because we were talking about this before.
It was bad. It was, they tested it like right before the games and said it was horrible.
But I was looking for things floating. I didn't see anything floating.
What they did. and this is what I, again, going from before the Olympics, I didn't obviously see it happening at the Olympics, but they were going to take boats out and clear that specific area of water where they were going to be swimming, and then having people like patrol outside of it to fish out the garbage before it got to the place where it would be on camera.
If that's what it takes.
Well, and that makes sense.
Clearly was. It did. Because I also didn't notice it. And I remember tuning in and seeing him be like, they're swimming in that dirty poop water. Where is all the poop? I didn't see it.
Well, it's like every Olympics where the homeless population is cleared out of the town while the games are going on, right? Like it's just
the games are
for
about
the cameras.
Optics. Yes.
It's for the viewing public. And if, you know, perception is reality. If you don't see the body parts floating around in the water, they don't exist.
They're just off camera. As long as the world doesn't see it.
Yeah, as long as you don't see those syringes, you're good. When we come back, so the Maple Leafs have had a good off season, but also kind of a disappointing one, missing out on yet another potential free agent acquisition. Jimmy Vesey headed to Manhattan, signing with the New York Rangers. And Sean Monahan signing a 7-year extension. What's next for the Flames? And does that mean a big deal is on the horizon for Johnny Gaudreau and the World Cup of Hockey starting up next month? That's coming up next. Ben Ennis alongside Jordan Heath Rawlings and Dan Robson at Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Send us all your money. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher, and we'll send you a free subscription for Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Absolutely free. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Ennis, Jordan Heath Rawlings, and Dan Robson. World Cup of Hockey coming up next month. We'll get into that in just a second, but one of the key free agents of this offseason. Now, the key free agent, that wrapped up a while ago. Steven Stamkos remaining in Tampa, sucking all the drama out of that thing. So we had to hang our hat on Jimmy Vesey, the Harvard man, opting not to sign with the team that drafted him, the Nashville Predators, deciding not to sign with the team that traded for his rights, the Buffalo Sabres, deciding not to trade for his hometown team, or not to sign with his hometown team, the Boston Bruins, and deciding not to sign with the team who employs his father and drafted his brother, the Toronto Maple Leafs, ends up in New York with the New York Rangers, which I think to most people was a big surprise. We'll talk about maybe his ability to make an impact at the NHL level, because guys with his track record that have done that are few and far between. But the Leafs in general, so they miss out on Steven Stamkos, and boy, a lot of people in this city really...
Everybody missed out, though. He was never even a free agent.
Right. Yeah, a lot of people really believed... He was a free agent. I mean, he met with a bunch of teams, and the poor Canadian Tire CEO had to get canned because he didn't do a good job of that pitch meeting. But so they miss out on Steven Stamkos, and they miss out on Jimmy Vesey. And I think the perception for most people in this city was that, yeah, now the Leafs are a destination you want to go to because they're this young, up-and-coming team. Is that incorrect?
If I had a dollar for every time I've heard the Leafs are a destination team, or the Raptors are going to become a destination, or the Blue Jays are now a destination team, players play where they want to play, and every player is different. And, you know, would you turn down if you'd just gotten out of college and were not signing an entry-level deal, so we're going to be making millions, and you had the chance to live in Manhattan and play for the Rangers, which is only like a couple hours train ride from your childhood home? Like, there's a million reasons that he could have stayed there. And I think it's all, first of all, I think it's ridiculous that we're talking about Jimmy Vesey as a key free agent, because who knows?
Well, you look at the full court press, so many teams around the league. I mean, and
sure, because it's a chance to acquire an asset for nothing, right? I mean, nothing but money.
Right, but there's a lot of free agents out there, and not everybody gets, you know, paraded around and gets, you know, you have to kiss the ring of the free agent like Jimmy Vesey was. He was clearly a different scenario than some of the other free agents out there.
I guess so. Some of the ones that are still left out there, for sure, obviously. But, I mean, the other thing that I think is kind of nuts is looking at the Leafs missing out on Jimmy Vesey and not getting a chance to sign Steven Stamkos, who stayed with his team, and saying that somehow signifies that they've had something of a disappointing offseason. I just don't see it.
I don't think you can have a disappointing offseason when you drafted
number one
overall. I mean, I think part of this is that, no, they're not a destination in the sense of I'm going to go there now, because they're not going to be a great team next year, and they're probably not going to be a great team 2 years from now. I mean, I think you have to, there's, we have to temper the expectations somewhat. And I think that it's, I don't think Toronto necessarily lost out on it, because I do think there's some risk in this acquisition as well, with signing Vesey and in New York. So, I mean, I don't know. I think with this storyline, like, I think you look at Toronto not getting him, fine. I'll wait to see what he's worth.
I mean, it's going to be interesting. The one thing I will say about the Maple Leafs that I'm really looking forward to seeing is how much patience this city really has now. You know, the appetite for losing was there last season because the new regime came in and they put the pieces in place and they spoke about patience and they talked about pain and it paid off. It really paid off. The question now is, are fans here prepared for another season of that? Because if they make the playoffs this year, they'll squeak in. They're right. They're not going to instantly turn this around. Like they spoke of it as a slow rebuild, and
but if they squeak in, that's an unqualified success for this team.
Yeah,
of course. But I mean, I'm not expecting that to happen. I guess all I'm saying is they spoke of it as a slow rebuild and people sort of bought in. But the first season isn't indicative of whether or not they're along for the long ride. Right. Do you know what I mean?
I think some people, I mean, there might be some expectation because they got the number one overall draft pick and thinking, oh my goodness, it's going to change right now. And that hype is going to be inevitable. But I think if you look down the future prospects that this team has, people coming up, if you're a fan, you have to be excited about it. You also have to understand how hockey works and realize that people have to develop into the players that you see. It's not the kind of sport where you can always just come in and have this ridiculously good impact, as you see with the Edmonton Oilers. I mean, you have a great impact personally, but it's not going to become a winner.
Well, I mean, the Edmonton Oilers are a perfect case study for when getting all sorts of controllable, excellent, highly touted young talent still can't make you instantly into a winner. And now I think people looking at those two teams would say that the difference between those two is the Leafs have the coaching and front office talent in place that is committed and proven themselves winners in other places and, you know, really seem to have built something that could eventually be sustainable. Whereas I think if you look at the Oilers for the last decade, has mostly been them flying by the seat of their pants and trying to make consecutive number one picks pan out.
Yeah, absolutely. But I don't think that you're going to have fans sort of up in arms. I mean, inevitably you'll have fans up in arms at
this
some
is
point.
Toronto.
Yeah,
after
it's going to happen. But I think the reality is you can't look at sort of Austin Matthews as the savior for hockey in Toronto. That's not how it's going to work.
Not like he's been on magazine covers and stuff.
Yeah. You can't put him on like a cover of a magazine and be like, this is the new. It'd be very irresponsible to do that.
Listen, Austin Matthews is going to be many, many things, hopefully for a long, long time in Toronto. But yeah, expecting him to do it this year is crazy. I mean, his best comparable is Jack Eichel, right? Who came in and I think had a pretty unqualified success of a rookie season last year. Started a little slow, but really came on at the end. But didn't turn around the fortunes of the Buffalo Sabres despite being on a team that was also had some serious young talent with him.
Yeah, and no one would say, oh, you know, Eichel's not a success. I mean, he absolutely is. I mean, Austin Matthews turns 19 in September. I mean,
And I mean, you look at the Sabres and they're essentially 1 year ahead of the Leafs on the rebuilding pole. Now, do you expect the Sabres to be really good this year? No, I would expect the Leafs to be slightly better this year than the Sabres were last year, which is
I think smart hockey fans in Toronto understand that. If they exist.
I'm so tempted to jump on them.
I think people understand that. And as far as burnout in year two, because that's what we're talking about, year two of this rebuild, that's pretty early to be burnt out already. And
yeah, they will. Some of them will.
We haven't seen a full season of the young kids too, right? It started to get exciting last couple of months of last season when William Nylander arrived. Let's see 82 games of Austin Matthews and Nylander and Marner. And Frederick Anderson, let's see what 82 games looks like with all this young talent.
Yeah, and it was interesting to see. I mean, I think maybe because Toronto was so starved for something to cheer about when the young guys came up last year, when you see Nylander and these players coming up and surprising people, saying, oh, okay, maybe there's something down the road. I think that there is an appetite for that. There's an appetite to watch growth and to see a core that can actually be bring winning hockey back to the city for the first time
eventually.
In more than a decade.
Yeah. Eventually. I think this season there'll be an appetite to watch those kids because I totally agree with you. When Nylander came up last year, it was exciting. There was very, very few reasons to watch any Maple Leafs hockey last year, but there was no question that 15 or so games, he was one of them.
there'll be excitement to see this Maple Leafs team when the season gets underway. You don't have to wait that long to see Austin Matthews, though, because he's going to be part of Team North America for the World Cup.
Well, that's my favorite team.
I think it's everybody's favorite team because, okay, we get it. It's not the Olympics, and it won't be.
Right.
And nobody's trying to sell it to you as the Olympics. It's an NHL-run tournament in which everybody's playing for money, but that's cool, too. Like, there is motivation. Yeah. There's money on the line here.
And all the best players are there.
It's a fabricated tournament. It's fabricated teams, but it's a high level, and the best players will be there. Even Johnny Gaudreau, without a contract as a restricted free agent, apparently going to play in this thing. Doesn't matter. He wants to play, and all the insurance is covered for all these players as well. But, yeah, it'll be, and in Toronto, to see Austin Matthews playing for Team North America, that is, talk about an indoctrination to one of the biggest hockey cities in the world. You get to play on against the world's best with some of the world's best as well.
With Connor McDavid.
How cool will that be?
So the four centers on that team, if you think about like the centers that they could play, would be McDavid, Eichel, Matthews, and Dylan Larkin.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just like, I don't think any of them are 20 yet. Maybe Eichel's turning 20, but like that is a ridiculous compilation of young talent. It's going to be so much fun to watch that team. They can skate circles around people.
When it was first announced, I have to admit, I was sort of like, what's happening here? It feels kind of gimmicky with that team. And because I was thinking of it as an international tournament on those, the standard, right? What I think of like those moments in Olympic glory when like Canada is, you know, and we're all behind it. But I think that when you think of it in different terms and look at what's happening, the potential to have these matchups with these players, I mean, it's just going to be exciting hockey to watch.
And my dirty little secret is that I love gimmicks. All of sports is a gimmick, essentially.
Sure. You love the XFL.
Yeah. I love, oh man, you send me down memory lane there. Yeah, yeah. You hate me and everything. Yeah. I think, you know, coming up with new and interesting things to try that might be entertaining to watch is something we should be doing more of in all sports.
And we're going to try out some new things at this World Cup of Hockey as well. There's a couple of things that will look a little different and are going to be kind of cool. The coaches, assistant coaches, are actually going to have iPads that they can access during the game, whether that's to review plays for challenges, whether that's to look over strategy. They're going to be able to do that in real time. Plus, there's tracking devices in everybody's jersey and in the puck. So that'll be interesting to see what kind of information we can take out of that. What I hoped we got a chance to see were some new goalie equipment, which we're not going to see. Apparently, it's not going to be ready in time for the World Cup of Hockey. And now there's a report in Mark Spector with a story on Sportsnet.ca that it's kind of looking doubtful for the start of the season. And maybe it happens midway through the season, but that's kind of a weird scenario. We might be looking at the 2017-2018 season as being the first for the new goalie equipment. That's a move I thought was a no-brainer that everybody was on board with, that we heard.
Except the goalies.
Well, and most goalies are in favor of it, though. I think it's probably the lousy ones that aren't, because they need their bigger pads to stay in the league. Defend your boys, the goalies, Dan.
No, I just don't think it's as big of a problem as everyone makes it out
to
be.
Bigger pads, right? You want it bigger.
I happen to think that saves are actually some of the most exciting parts of hockey. So I'd like to see more stopped pucks. I know
right, but you have to move to do it. Don't just be the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man.
They've addressed this issue many times, and I understand that people are talking about making the net bigger, and I think goalies,
yes,
watching goaltenders, I'm not bored by any goaltender that plays right now. I think that they're all exciting to watch. So look, I get that they need to streamline the pads, and I guess that everyone's, you know, concerned about how great goalies are these days, and they're too fat in the net. But I think I've never saw it as like this big issue that like the NHL desperately needs to take care of.
I'm not concerned with, you know, watching goalies make saves. I
shouldn't be.
No, I'd like to see them miss a few more pucks here and there. Help my fantasy team out, you know, get some more highlights rolling. But the thing that bothers me about this whole debate is that the way tradition plays into it. And when, you know, we started talking about this, and then Dan casually throws out, oh, some people, and he looks right at me here, are going to want to make the nets bigger. And isn't that ridiculous? But it's not ridiculous. You can do it. There's no reason that you can't.
I'd much rather streamline the equipment than change the size.
Fine, but you can change the nets. It's not like something that should be discussed as you though like it's this
man.
Outlandish. Yeah, I am. I want to fix sports and make them more entertaining and better. If that means I got to make the nets 2 inches bigger, sorry, goalies, you had your chance to wear smaller equipment. You wouldn't do that. Now you got big nets.
Yeah, whoops. I can't handle that, though. I don't know. I just can't make it 3-on-3 all the time. Just like,
wow, that was a fun All-Star game.
It was a gimmick. It worked. And the All-Star game is fine for a gimmick, but it's just it would just absolutely ruin the sport. And
what about 4-on-4 overtime? Does that ruin the sport?
Well, I mean, that's it. I don't mind 4-on-4. I think we can discuss it. I don't.
So the gimmicks only are good if they work for
like,
Dan Robson.
What I'd like, well, yeah, I'd like there to be just continuous overtime. I find that to be interesting. Yeah. 4-on-4 is fine, but it's
or
interesting.
3-on-3, yeah, for this.
It should go to 4-on-4, then to 3-on-3, yeah. Then to 2-on-2, and then the goalies just have to take penalty shots on each other. Right. See, now that is a gimmick.
But that's not changing the numbers of the game. It's not changing the size of the goal. Like that kind of stuff is just.
But the size of the rinks has changed over time.
Yes, it has.
And the blue line, the center line's gone away, and you know various things have changed, and the size of the nets could change too. You know the same way football decided to move the field, the extra point back, right? Like as long as you're not destroying what is the essence of the game, which is you know skaters trying to put a puck in the net. I'm on board with trying stuff.
One of the problems I have with the net idea is also, and I'll defend goalies again here for a second, but. The position it's entirely dependent on understanding angles and understanding the diameter of what's behind you. And so when you have to retrain.
I totally get that.
How you're lining up with the lines and how you're lining up on the like all of that stuff will be very difficult to do. And I think that's why it's something that won't happen.
It will be, but this is, and I agree with you that it would be exceedingly difficult for the goalies who have spent their whole lives learning to defend this size net. And I sympathize with that, but it's going to be exceedingly difficult for that one generation of goalies. And then the next generation of goalies will come up with the new nets and they'll be fine.
Nah.
I think the problem is not with goals being scored, it's scoring chances as well, which none of these things
ban coaching.
Ban coaching. that's a topic for the next show because we're out of time. That'll do it for Jordan Heath Rawlings and Dan Robson. I'm Ben Ennis. This has been Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.